and welcome back to another episode of the Geek Whisperers. I'm Amy Lewis.
I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And we are live on the floor. Well, not exactly. For once, we actually have chairs. We are at Spice World Austin, coming to you. And not only are we sitting in here, what looks like an interrogation room, we have somebody awesome to interrogate. So, Tom, would you introduce yourselves to our audience?
Hi, I'm Tom Lumencelli.
And tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm an SRE, which is a site reliability engineer at Stack Exchange. I'm an author and all-around geek.
he's our favorite kind of unicorn. We were going around the table to see what backgrounds were, and he and Matt are on the computer science side of the table.
Oh, yeah. And slightly self-loathing marketing, too. I mean, you do a good job at communicating.
Thank you. I guess that's a compliment. I feel like it's I'm a shameless self-promoter.
And that's what we're going to dig into today, aren't we?
Yeah. But see, that's the best part about technologists who think that they're shameless self-promoters. If you actually look at real shameless self-promoters, like who are actual marketers, that's much different. That's like a whole different beast, right? Yeah.
There's more to be ashamed of that we don't
exactly.
do. So take us away.
Anyway, some more shameless self-promotion. Go for it, Amy.
So, Tom, you were telling us a little bit of your background. You've published some books. And you published in an age before, believe it or not, Matt, there was a world before social networking.
Please tell me, Amy. Teach me of these past ways.
There were dinosaurs. So you published books in an age where there were no bloggers. You were blogging before there was blogging. So tell us about coming of age as a technologist in this, you know.
So in 98, 99, I started speaking at conferences at the suggestion of my boss, who thought it would help my career to start writing papers. And so these were academic conferences. And after giving a presentation at a conference, a publisher who was there to recruit new authors approached me about writing a book. And I had some ideas, but this was, you know, 99. The internet was still not new, but e-commerce was just taking off. And I ended up writing a book literally with someone I had not met in person more than a couple times, which was crazy for this day. Like, you did your collaboration over the internet? How did that work? And
I'm listening.
Yeah, right. The publisher was amazed that we weren't emailing chapters back and forth. We actually had like a collaborative tool to use, which they wanted to know all about. The book came out the week before 9/11. So the entire marketing plan for those 3 months basically disappeared.
Yeah.
And after that, we said, wow, our publisher only, they budget a certain amount of time and energy for marketing a book, and that had been exhausted with not much to show for it. So we had to go on our own, and we started contacting every conference in the world that would let us speak, and that got us usually on our own dime, but we spoke in Europe and the U.S. and eventually Australia. And we didn't have the social networking and, you know.
So it was good old-fashioned sweat equity marketing.
It was sweat equity marketing, yeah.
Well, Tom, I wanted to, before we go through all the marketing stuff, I was curious. This one is, it was about system and network administration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were, this was, 2001. You know, you were early mid-career,
mm-hmm.
and so one of the questions that we sometimes get is to write a book, you have to figure out or believe or at least make, you know, assume that you have the authority to write a book, and like that's a, like, I'm looking at the title, The Practice of System and Network Administration. That's like a fairly like definitive, like, you know, this is how you be a system administrator. So, and some, for some people, that's a kind of a struggle to like, oh, wait a minute. No, I do know enough to write a book. Where were you on your career path, and how did you come up with the idea to write the
book? Good question. So there's a myth in publishing that you have to know what you're talking about to write a book.
This is why we're called the Geek Whisperers.
So it turns out you get credibility having written a book.
That's awesome.
We're working on this.
It's not the other way around. So if someone had told us that what we were doing was impossible, we would have given up. And maybe people did tell us this, but luckily the hubris right. and ego let us ignore them. And so we were able to do impossible things. And actually, I went back through email and I did find one email that someone reviewed our proposed table of contents and was like, this is crap. This is not what computing is going to be about in the future. And basically, he described the book that we just wrote.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So so he was way ahead of his time. Too ahead for me. But so that first book was literally Christine Hogan and I said, let's try to write down all the conventional wisdom that we pick up at the USENIX LISA conference, tell all those stories that we find ourselves telling over and over again, and you know, we literally made index cards of, you know, one for each story we wanted to tell, figured out that they were kind of in piles, and you know, categorized them, and those became our chapters, and then we fit in the technical stuff around them to let us tell those stories. So if there had been a blog at the time, these would have been the stories we blogged.
Oh, yeah, an information architecture. That's truthfully, there's another secret. I was in publishing before, so mm-hmm. it's really just an information architecture. That's a table of contents.
And I immediately went to like agile development today. It sounds like you wrote down each card and like made little checklists and Kanban style workflow of what you were doing.
People laugh that we used index cards, but believe me, the brilliant. Index card business will never go out of business because it's so useful because it forces you away from the computer.
Yes.
It forces you to not deal with the font and the formatting and all that stuff. Though I have to say that Trello is really cool, and now I'm a little biased because that company has the same CEO as the company I work for. So we were using it, you know, a long time. But but if you really want a good brainstorming session, get away from the computer, buy the 3-foot big pads of paper, get away from the video conferencing if you can, and fly to be in the same place at the same time.
Such great advice. And I want to pull out one other thing you said. You talked about you had a supportive boss. That struck me too when you said your boss said, this will be good for your career. Get out there and do this.
Yeah. And I don't think he expected me to go on writing books, but I left Bell Labs. I finished the book while I was at a different company, and the warning I should give is that when writing a book takes a lot of your time, and if you will get lower performance reviews the year or two that you're writing that book,
that's
than
really
other years.
That's something to think about, like how to do work-life balance. We have people who get in and even collaboratively writing a chapter or doing something like that, and they're like, wow, this is so consider it. You're saying go in with consideration, know what you're in for,
right? Just for me, it's difficult to motivate myself, and so a trick that I found, which was a trick from another author, he recommended this. He said, you need to eliminate the things in your life that are more fun than writing a book. And the question is, so what's more fun than writing? Well, it turns out everything.
Coffee almost went out my nose.
And so it was 2 years of saying no to social engagements and stuff. Like, I could go to a party on a Saturday if it started after 8 o'clock, but I couldn't plan parties. And I used to throw I used to be the social like instigator. So there was that. There was, you know, it affects dating and just everything. And if you're used to working late every night, you have to start going home at 5 o'clock so that you do right. So I ended up with a plan where it was 2 work nights a week and all Saturday and all Sunday.
Wow.
And though that got canceled a lot because I have a lot of weekend obligations and stuff, conferences and just, you know, things that I didn't want to give up. And so on those productive months, it was all of that.
That's great.
And I think that, yeah, just seat time, to use the NASCAR term, or the, you know, if you go Malcolm Gladwell with, like, how many hours you need, I think there is something to the discipline of writing. And I think that's a great, that you had a structure.
That was a good brass tacks, like, get down to it, like, what's going to actually get you there. I would love to get back to producing a book. Like, so the conference scene gave you an opportunity to advertise in the early 2000s on your first book. Your more recent piece, like, you had just a totally new portfolio of channels to use. If you think about social media, think about the I mean, you had quite a following already.
Let's go ahead and give a plug.
Well, shameless plug.
shameless promotion. Your new book coming out, or is it already out?
It's out as of last week.
Oh, congratulations.
Congrats.
The Practice of Cloud System Administration.
Yes.
Okay, so definitely an echo of the first one. So now it's all the new stuff in theory that
it's
we
all the
could
new stuff.
We should know how to do.
It's really the service book. It's how to run a service. It's the first part is designing the technical infrastructure for services, and it has cloud in the title, but really these all apply to all levels of engineering. And then the last two thirds is all about how to run these infrastructures. So everything from how to organize an on-call schedule to interacting with developers and everything. So it's not super technical. I think most managers can read this and feel like, oh, now I know what I should be telling my IT team to do.
That's brilliant, Tom. And I'm really curious from just an implementation standpoint. So you produce this book. I'm sure there's a lot of saying no to all the fun things that you could do instead in the meantime. And then how did you go about choosing a company to work with to produce the book? And how did you go about choosing to advertise it and choosing conferences and communities to be a part of?
Right. Well, the selection of our publisher was basically driven by the fact that we wanted to have the title be very similar to our previous book, and that meant going with our previous
publisher. Absolutely.
Okay. So that was kind of easy. Mm-hmm. For anyone new in this, every publisher has a link that, you know, click here to submit a proposal.
Oh.
You probably want to also consider self-publishing. You know, it depends on what your goal is. Like this book, it's a textbook, technically, which the definition of textbook means you've put questions at the end of each chapter.
but we're learning a lot here.
But then the sales force of Pearson can go to every university, which they constantly do, and say, now we have this textbook. And so
absolutely,
that's a whole sales channel.
That's a great point for listeners, people who are going into this, that there are some tricks. Do some research here, because small things like that can make a big impact on the sales channels you can access.
Huh. Okay, so you made a textbook, and so that gives you the academic angle of it.
Right.
There's also, I'm sure there's also a community angle of this, or
there's
a broader
community
reach.
Yeah, so we, you know, I don't think we invented much in this book. This is similar to the previous one. It's, you know, let's collect the conventional wisdom. What are the things that all my friends know that aren't in books yet? Let's see if I could tell this story really quickly. Well, the short version is Kevin Smith, the director, he made Clerks and Jane, Silent Bob, tells this story about when he was young, he loved watching comedies, but he always was upset that these movies never had characters that were like his friends. How come his friends aren't represented in these movies? And one day he realized, well, that's only going to happen if I make a movie. And that's why he made Clerks. And this has kind of been my structure for books. Like, how come no one's written down all this stuff? How come we have to go to conferences and the, you know, tiny group of people that can attend conferences to share this information are benefiting? I'm going to write all this down. I was also able to, you know, research a lot and, you know, include things from my Google background and other companies. And so, you know, I'll be humble and say I've invented 10% of what's in the book, but the rest is, you know.
Well, I mean, don't undersell curation. We're in a society that is inundated with fantastic amounts of information, but the quality curation of that into like a nice legible storyline and things that are just basic practices, there will always be room for that.
It's turning big data into information, right? It's adding some context.
Sure.
And curation is context in a way.
And if you're looking for a book idea, my best recommendation is if you're at, you know, a cocktail party or hanging out with friends, if there's a topic that when it comes up, you always rant about the same, like, 10 points related to that, that's your book. You have that's 10 great. Points. You make a chapter out of each one. Write a chapter a month. It's a one-year project if you add the intro and the conclusion chapter. 12 chapters. Keep it nice and simple, and it's a one-year project.
I love this. And I love – the other thing we were talking about a little bit is work-life balance. And in some ways, how about work-book balance? So when you are doing, when you are doing a book like this, you talked about going to your day job and how to align that. But also I would assume you need lab time, research time for the book. How and that's a great lead-in. So here's how you can get your table of contents and structure based on what you know you're talking about over and over again. How do you go out and do that research? How do you get the lab time? How do you find the nuggets? How do you pull it together? What are some of your tips there?
Right. Well, let's see.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean.
So, well, my books don't have actually a lot of, you know, code and lab research because we keep it at a higher level, more, you know, vendor agnostic. So a lot of our research is mostly by talking with people, getting feedback. Actually, a huge amount of effort is spent just on the table of contents.
Yeah.
I think we spend 6 months on the table of contents. Just from the initial plan to showing it to people, getting feedback. I remember sitting at lunch at a conference a year and a half ago with Gene Kim and Jez Humble and saying, with my laptop, saying, this is our table of contents. Tell me what's wrong with it. And they were pointing stuff out. And then, oh, in that chapter, you really need to include this anecdote and blah, 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 blah. And,
that's really powerful.
And then I'd corner people one-on-one and say, what was wrong with my old book? Like, what?
Oh,
what,
nice.
What do people don't say because they don't want to offend me or whatever. And I got some really honest.
It's kind of like lean startup sort of technologies. Like you go and you go out with the idea for the startup. You go out with the table of contents,
right.
Validate that, and then write the book or start the company off of the validation.
Yeah. Or the carpentry adage, right? Measure twice, cut once.
Yeah, exactly. And it's always tempting to add more chapters. It's really hard to cut, and so, but cutting's really important. We don't do a good job of that. My 12 chapter recommendation, this book has 21 chapters. I actually got that advice about a week after I finished my first book, which had 35 chapters, and we had killed ourselves writing 4 chapters a month for a year.
Wow.
Chris wrote 2 chapters, I wrote 2 chapters, and then we edited each other's chapters. And it was just a hellish year. And then my coworker and also author Bill Cheswick said, you know what I like? When I write my books, blah, 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 12 chapters, one-year project. And I was like, thanks, Bill. You told me this 2 years ago.
It's like April Fool's.
There's one other thing, Amy. I don't want us to jump past it too fast, because something you said, Tom, that I really connect with is that you went after that critical angle of your writing. You wanted to improve upon a past experience, and you made people comfortable to give you that feedback very candidly and honestly. And there's something I've read more than once that, like, that is the true power of reaching out to people in the networks that we create, is getting that really candid feedback that isn't always easy to hear, but will improve you exponentially versus something like people just patting you on the back saying good job every time.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, one of the reasons that I'm a big supporter of music education and music theater and stuff is that, and art in school, is that one thing that you learn is iterative processes with criticism. You know, you're not just painting a picture. You're painting it, and then a good teacher will say, you know, this is where you can improve, and this is what you're doing. Not, they probably won't say wrong, but they're basically saying this is what you're doing wrong. And if you grow up being able to accept criticism, that is a skill that is going to help you everywhere. And public schools can't have a class in accepting criticism. Like, you couldn't teach that. So what you have to do is you have to have
art and
awesome. And similar with, you know, science education. Everyone sees, you know, on Star Trek, they come up with the solution instantly. But what I think the reason students are afraid of science classes because the labs don't go right on the first try like they do on TV. And you have to learn that nothing works right on the first try.
So it's good. It's good time. We've got half the table is Comsky, and the other half, you know, you are. We've got John with a science background. I'm a failed scientist. My secret story was I was on the chemistry track and then went liberal.
Well, I think sysadmins have to know. I mean, they quickly learn that not everything goes right, and you have to sit there until it works. So I was curious. Did we get to the differences in promoting a book in 2014?
Oh, no. So now let's talk about the new thing. So in the intervening years, I developed a blog, and I always joke the dozens of people that read my blog. But
how many of them are related? That's always
right. My mom thinks my blog is great. My mom probably doesn't know I have a blog.
We've got at least a dozen people listening to this.
Good. That's where we start. So what I found is that the readership of my blog was directly correlates to how often I write. So I would go months without writing anything, and readership goes down. If I would force myself to write, then readership goes up. And that's kind of how I was maintaining my audience, so that for future books they would, I would have their ear.
Yeah, you'd already have them kind of warm and interested.
Right.
Yeah.
So, anytime I send an email to someone that's more than a couple screenfuls, I think, oh, can I turn this into a blog post? In fact, recently I did a blog post that I didn't even edit the email. I said, here's an email I sent to a friend recently. And I changed the company name that we were talking about, but it was like this, not diatribe, but my understanding of what the publishing industry thinks is happening with technical books. Mm-hmm. And
that's interesting to a broader audience. It absolutely is.
Right.
We're going to have to link to that one in the podcast. That sounds like...
Right. And about once a year, someone sends me an email asking for advice. I'm like, thank God, because this will be a podcast. Right?
Well, and this ties me into the question I wanted to ask, too. You talked about in the iterative process of the book, in both content creation and the promotion, I would think. How do you select the communities of interest and the events you go to? Because I love how you pull that in. I don't know that that's a way people have often thought about their time when they're making a justification to their boss. You know, they talk about it as personal education, but the idea of documenting and using that experience for this kind of bigger and greater good is really well said by you. How do you choose which conferences to go to and which communities to participate in? Because your time is finite. You've got these blog posts to write.
Well, I have a very sophisticated strategy, coordinating location, audience, total addressable market. Put it into a big spreadsheet, and then
Hadoop cluster.
And then
cluster
pop it into
processes
Redis.
It all. Actually, it's mostly audience and mostly where I'd like to travel to. So
Boston.
I've been to Australia 5 times.
Nice.
Well done.
For 2 different conferences, one that has had me back a number of times, the other didn't, which...
worth it.
Yeah, totally worth it. What else? I don't have a super strategy.
Well, tell me this.
I guess it's mostly audience that I want to hit, try to hit a couple East Coast, a couple West Coast,
Smart.
That kind of thing. And also, if someone's willing to pay my travel, then it's a much easier decision than if I'm fronting the bill.
Well, I'm kind of curious. About the community here. So we're here at Spice World.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting sysadmin community. Very hardcore sysadmins. I think they call themselves sysadmins. Maybe
they call themselves IT pros.
Well, this is so one. The word sysadmin, and two, is there a thread of connection between the people here in this room and the people at a Usenix conference in 1999?
Sure. Every conference attracts a different market. So Usenix is more. It used to be more the academics talking about the results of their research and how it applies to system administration. And over the years, it's become more practitioner-focused. And like this year, you would not recognize the schedule compared to previous years. It's head-on DevOps, cutting-edge. I mean, the one word that can describe the whole schedule grid is the word new. Mm. It's all new stuff. And I swear, a third of it is stuff that if you attend that session a year from now, all your coworkers are going to be learning that stuff, and they're going to think, oh, you know, Joe or Mary, they were so advanced. How did they know about this stuff? And
that's really interesting.
Yeah. Spiceworks, very focused on small and medium business. Build a solution, more buy a solution. Mm-hmm. Let's see, what I think. The European conferences tend to be more build a solution, more technical. Though they have, at least the conferences I attend, I mean, they also have.
Well, that's the thing. One of the reasons I asked that is you know, for the last, you know, decade, I've been working in vendor communities, right? So, like, there are sysadmins or IT pros that just go to VMware.
Right.
They go to VMworld, they are VMware admin or EMC or Cisco.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And I always wondered why Usenix never took over the world, because... And I have a particular bias, because that's kind of what I'm doing now, is trying to connect cross-vendor IT pro communities and figure that out.
Right. Well, IT pros have figured out that it can really help their career to be the expert in something instead of the jack-of-all-trades.
Yeah.
So if you are the storage person, the VMware person, then you can go to the VMware conference, you can get a certification, you can be the expert that people go to, and companies value that.
Mm.
I think going in the future, but see, the problem with that is it makes you a silo.
Yep.
And I think in the future, companies want to break down silos, and so there's going to be a big push to not be, you know, I just do VMware, but I, you know, integrate that, and I understand the other needs of other teams. I think a big word you're going to start hearing a year or two from now is going to be empathy. Because that's the new term for, it's not just breaking down a silo. That sounds scary. That's like, my silo is very comfortable. Don't break down my silo. We is in silos for a reason, right?
Keep it dry, people.
Keep it dry. But so a less scary term is empathy. Like, how does what my team do affect the other teams, and how do we all play together? And
is that to hide the word DevOps?
Well, it's a word that comes from the DevOps movement, certainly.
Well, I have to shameless self-plug. I'm smiling while you say that. I run another show called Engineers Unplugged that happened to have Matt and John on recently that talked exactly about that career evolution. So maybe we can link to that.
Shameless self-promotion.
I know you like that.
But being T-shaped expertise, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. One more thing about conferences is people don't realize that conference organizers are desperate for good speakers. So don't submit, like, people think, oh, I can't submit, you know, they don't want me. They probably want you if you're talking about something new, if you're not blatantly trying to sell something. You know, you need to, as Tim O'Reilly says, produce more value than you take, right?
Love it.
So, I mean, I love that phrase. It just totally blows me away. So if you are promoting, you know, a book, you can't propose, like, I'm going to come and talk about my book. You have to pick the coolest thing that you say in your book and propose talking about that.
Yes.
And then you don't even need to talk about the book. I was so afraid that I was giving away the secret bits of the book and now people wouldn't need to buy the book.
Right.
It's the opposite. The more you give away about the book, the more excited people get about it and they want to buy it.
Oh, my God.
This is
so good.
So much goodness. Okay, so we're about to wrap up here. We always like to end not on a sour note, but on a you know, helpful, like, what if you had something you would tell someone, hey, I would do this differently, or learn from this, you know, don't ever do this, or do more of this. You can frame it positive or negative, but if you gave someone who's considering authorship, or, you know.
Okay. The one thing I would never do again is hide from my coworkers and boss that I'm writing a book.
Ooh,
because they think, you know, so a friend did this and they thought that the person was just kind of like preoccupied and ignoring them and wasn't available as they could be, and instead you need to let them know, and, you know, it's probably going to sound egotistical, but you have to say, you know, I'm working on this book, and make them a part of the process instead of, like, I'm trying to get this done in my spare time. You're still getting done in your spare time. You can't write on company time unless, you know, if you get that gig, go for it. Yeah.
That is such a great, love that. It's a community, and make people a broader part of your community. It takes
Get people on your team.
Yeah.
It's actually like a essential part of managing up and peer-to-peer relationships too. Like, let people in a little bit so they can see your ambition and don't, like, stare that in the face and don't run away.
And they'll hate you if it's all you talk about at lunch.
Yeah.
So don't do that. But
these are great tips. Tom, this has been so much fun. It is such a pleasure to get to know you, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
So where can people find you? Where is best to engage with you or to buy your book? We'll obviously link to that on Amazon, but what about to you personally?
My blog is everythingsysadmin.com, and more about the book is on thecloudbook.com. So it's hyphenated, the-cloud-book.com.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as J. Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.
One thing I'll never do again.
Yeah.
One thing I'll never do again.
It's like a party game.
She's tricky. She always asks these.
With no warning. We're going to cut out all the silence.
Yeah. If we're going to edit this, let me take a second to think.
Yeah, feel free. Jump on a podcast with people.